I think we're going to have an interesting panel here. I think the United States is probably fairly unique in terms of countries, in terms of the role that the foundations play in economic development. In Rust Belt, where I come from, companies may die, but they leave their money to their communities in the way of foundations, and it's a way of actually getting things started again. And the neat thing about it is that it's a way to do it very, very creatively, that through a grant process and look at the best ideas. And I'm not just going to spend a lot of time doing it, but we have excellent speakers here, both from Pittsburgh and from Northern California. Two very different kinds of foundations, different approaches, different areas. Pittsburgh, Heinz Foundation, as a Pittsburgher growing up, I can say Heinz Foundation is a godsend to the area, in that it's so focused on how the on the area, how to make the area better, how to revive the community, how to strengthen the universities, that it'd be hard to think of Pittsburgh without it. And Silicon Valley is just beginning to have the benefits of their generations of very successful people returning to the community. And it's a different set of problems, as we heard in the last panel, that it's not exactly clusters that they have. So I think it will be interesting to hear the approaches. And without further ado, let me turn it over to Chris.
Thanks very much, Jim. And I actually want to congratulate all of you for still being here. We were talking to Chuck earlier today, and I said I was afraid at this hour we were going to outnumber the audience. So really glad that you're all here. We're really fortunate in the Pittsburgh area to have the benefits of the entrepreneurs of 100 years ago, who actually, that's why we have such a large foundation community. I think second only to possibly Seattle, but I think we're number one, number two, or number three in terms of number of foundation dollars in our region. Senator Heinz, before he died in 91, said that the Heinz Endowments should be working on, our foundation is focused on our region, but the idea is to use our region as a living laboratory for problems that are national in scope. And we've always tried to do that. And Mrs. Heinz, after the senator died, she's now the chair of our board, Teresa Heinz, and she is absolutely a visionary. She led the world in terms of green building. We now have the largest green convention center, which is why the G20 is coming to Pittsburgh this September. And there were articles in the paper all week about how, this was just announced on Thursday, about how Pittsburgh's transformation, et cetera, this is why, and our ability to be a green city is the reason why the G20 is there. And we'd like to tell you about some of what we're doing that relates to what you care about. These numbers that you see on the slide, if you think about 2,532 neighborhoods, 992 cities, and 1 million people displaced. We'll explain what that means later for those of you who aren't aware of the history. But that means that this matters to you, because 992 cities, probably every one of your cities has been touched by this, and we'll explain what we mean. All day we've been talking about federal policy for clusters, and look at, these are the largest clusters that everybody who lives in places other than where these stars are is always trying to be one of these stars, and looking at what has worked in other regions. How do we build these clusters? This has been the topic of the conference today. But you really cannot think about the success of these clusters without accepting the role of federal policy and funding. And a lot of people will write about Silicon Valley and talk about the great entrepreneurs and the network effects, but you really need to remember that every year since World War II, both Boston and Silicon Valley have had hundreds of millions of current year dollars poured on their research universities. And so after 65 years of this, I mean, it would be pretty shocking if they weren't the centers of innovation. And all of the other programs in the country that are trying to do this are really trying to accelerate that process, so it doesn't take us all 65 years and that level of federal funding. In the same way, you cannot consider the nation's economically distressed communities without recognizing the role that federal policy and federal funding played over many, many years in order to make these communities inevitable. And I think it's really important to talk about these two issues in the same breath, because it really isn't just about innovation clusters. It's about how innovation clusters are situated in their communities, how innovation clusters can really lift all boats, and how innovation clusters cannot really exist and be successful if there's a wall around them. And someone earlier today talked about the university and the university parks and all the innovation cluster. And then over there, within the stone's throw, there's this neighborhood that you wouldn't want your kids to be living in. And that's really what we want to talk about today, is those communities where you wouldn't want your kids to be living. Those communities were created in no small measure because of federal policy and federal funding over a period of years. And if you've never read a book called Root Shock by Mindy Thompson Fully Love, it's well worth getting. It's not an expensive book. It'll take you about an afternoon to read, and it will really open your eyes to what's been happening. It's a really nice piece of research. It talks about urban renewal. After World War II, many people felt that cities were declining. This was a lot of things were happening after World War II. Everybody was trying to rejuvenate the economy, the 50s. People thought cities were declining. People were moving to the suburbs because the buildings were aging and that the street grid patterns were out of date. And if we could just create things that looked like shopping malls in the cities, people would come rushing back. Well, we all know how wrong that was. This cartoon shows a combine, basically, of you just scooping up these old aging buildings and plopping down these beautiful, stark, high-rise buildings. But we all know what those buildings were. They were like Cabrini Green in Chicago. The other picture shows Mayor David Lawrence in Pittsburgh bashing a building and all these guys being very proud of that they were doing this. The Pittsburgh experience is important when you ask about the foundation role. At that time, the foundations in Pittsburgh were doing exactly what you would hope they would do. They were taking the lead. We were putting money into this. Richard King Mellon, which is now the largest foundation in Pittsburgh, Richard King Mellon himself was involved with this. The mayor, David Lawrence, was very strong, and the Allegheny Conference on Community Development was forming, and very, very proudly grabbing this initiative of urban renewal before anyone else in the country and getting started on it. We took our smoky city and we turned where the two rivers came together to form the Ohio River into the golden triangle of the Point. It was a major, major success story, and because of that success, we felt that we could do other things. So across the river in a place that used to be called Allegheny City, which is now the north side of Pittsburgh, look at how many city blocks were bulldozed because we really wanted to create something new. And what you had was now instead of a nice accessible park in a city and a beautiful market where it was just vibrant every weekend, people would be there all the time, you now have a very empty neighborhood where the street grid was actually cut off forcibly by what is now a very empty building called Allegheny Center Mall, which I think lasted maybe 5 or 6 years as anything successful. Similarly, there's a section of the city called East Liberty where it was in 1928 a vibrant economic sector. By 1970, it was sort of like a shopping mall. And now today, you see, we're knocking down buildings, and the foundations, again, have come in to fund a community plan to try to recreate that whole neighborhood and make it better. Pittsburgh's third failed project is the Hill District, and this is the one we're going to focus on, because I think if you can find areas in your city that look like this, it's well worth taking a look. This is August Wilson's neighborhood. This is right between downtown and the universities, and we'll talk more about that later, but the picture on the left shows the street grid that used to be there, that's where the business district was, and the city. And I think you have to also recognize the influence of actually overt racism in those years. Of what the mantra in Pittsburgh was, urban renewal is Negro removal, and we just forced 100 city blocks and just pushed the black community back so that the downtown could have a nice cultural district. And you see now what we have there now is a parking lot, really, where those blocks used to be, and this civic arena, which was a dome. It was a very forward-looking cultural venue, and you see August Wilson at the bottom of the screen. So what we're talking about is these are economies that are living right next to you, almost certainly right next to your universities, right next to the places where your innovation clusters are located, and these communities have been bulldozed, and they've been forcibly turned into economically distressed communities by really failed, misguided, misanthropic, policy of many years, and again, one more wave of destruction happened there. So this is where we're looking. This is the downtown. You see the Golden Triangle where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers come together to form the Ohio. You see the downtown Golden Triangle and the downtown business district. The Hill District is this very large area. By Hill District, it's really up there. It's high. It's got beautiful views. It's an incredible piece of real estate right in the heart of our community. And Oakland and the universities and medical centers are there. So here's something you can do at home. Okay, we just took Google Earth, and you can take, you should do this actually with any of your communities. Find your satellite map on Google Earth and start to play. Google Earth has this little feature that says, where are the places of interest? And you can say, okay, where are the bars and clubs? And up come the icons. Where are the coffee shops? Where are the, and you just go through, where are all the amenities and where are they? And you go through and you see where they all are. And then you say, what we're looking at is we've actually done a very good job with all our technology-based economic development organizations. Rebecca was telling you earlier. They've actually been quite successful. The Ben Franklin program is 26 years old, and it's been around for a long time, doing all of the same kinds of things that you're doing with your programs. And as a result, we have lots of clusters that are beginning to form organically, most of them centered around university spin-offs. So, for example, the robotics companies are located in this place along the river called the Strip District, which is down below the hill. It's about 150 feet below the hill, so it's not, it's up there next to the river. You're seeing software companies aggregating on the south side because of, just because one of them started there and the others wanted to be nearby, and there are some interesting old buildings. You're seeing gaming companies. That's near the Entertainment Technology Center, which is where, you know, you probably all read Randy Pausch's book. He and Don Marinelli started a center. They've spun out half a dozen, actually almost a dozen companies now, and they're all located right there. And you're seeing arts companies actually starting in Lawrenceville, the creative economy that someone mentioned. And you're seeing biotech and infotech, as you'd expect, right next to the universities. Look at that. Just look at that graph. And what's happening is that the hill, which has no amenities, is empty, even though it's right in the heart of our community. So I want to turn it over to Bomani now to pick up or to talk a little bit more about that.
Afternoon. Thank you all for staying. We're quite glad that we don't outnumber you. Talk a bit about innovation from quite of a bit different perspective. I'd like to look at innovation from a community-based level and consider some of the historic culture of these communities that we work with. From a funder's perspective, we find it necessary in terms of the level of impact that our funding is going to have to really get down on the ground level and understand the history and culture of many of the neighborhoods that we send our funding in. So we'd like to liken it to a jazz quartet where there's structure in the music, but there's a lot of free, flowing, organic freedom. And so we'd like to talk about how some of the innovation of the cultural aspects of these communities might lend us lend itself to some of the innovation that we see in the technology centers across just down the road in many instances. And so there was an American Idol moment going on here earlier when folks were talking about what type of artists they were. I'm the August Wilson of innovation. This is just a picture of many of the projects that are going on. There's a lot of synergy going on in this downtown. Chris showed you earlier the 28-acre open urban space that was bulldozed early, and now there are a lot of projects that are popping up. And so this just gives you an idea of the type of synergy that's going on. But the real critical issue is, how does this connect to community-based small business development initiatives? So we'd like to engage in some of our recommendations, and I'm going to come back to this screen in just a moment. I want to talk about the PCKIZ, the Pittsburgh Central Keystone Innovation Zone. This is a state program. And this state program is just an example of how our philanthropic dollars can be complemented with other monies to attract private interests. And when it comes to workforce and workforce development, we're hoping that it's industry-led and that they're out in the front so that people aren't getting trained for jobs that won't be there. So let me just talk about the PCKIZ. This is a state-run program, and it runs centrally through downtown Pittsburgh. You'll see in the blue, these are the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers, and I'll show you some beautiful views of it. It sits right in the middle of the second and third highest revenue generators for the state of Pennsylvania. So you have this very economically depressed area sitting right in the middle of the second and third largest generators of revenue. So it stretches across the north side. It includes the area down on 2nd Avenue where there's a technology corridor. Saw some of the folks from Innovation Works. So if you haven't gotten to meet Matt Harbaugh and Rich Lunak, you should probably do so before you leave. In the central part of the KIZ, you have this run being run by Bill Jenneret, who's the leader of that. And what he found was that the initiative to attract small businesses to the – thank you. I was hoping somebody would have one of these. So the in the middle here is the Hill District, and one of the initiatives was to make sure that we can attract small businesses to the area. Found that to be a challenge because of all the amenities being absent from that central area. I'm going to kind of speed up. I see my yellow light coming. And so the basic idea is we have all of these clusters developing, biotech, infotech here, out in the Oakland area, games, gaming out on the across the Monongahela on the south side, software, robotics and the arts. And the idea is to try to bring these clusters together to bring the strengths to a central point and to help strengthen those neighborhoods. Pittsburgh has many incredible, incredible views, and I'm not going to go into this, but you'll see that this is you have a lot of technology going on down in this area. We want to make sure that we have direct and deliberate bridges to anchor innovation clusters into the community. I'm talking about grassroots, community-driven. So I'm encouraged by Van Jones, who's saying, let's green the ghettos, and Sean Donovan, who's saying, let's put the UD back in HUD, because a long time ago, somebody put the double OD back in HUD. And so this is just a quick project that we're moving on. Here you see, when I was a child, all of this was just blank. There was nothing there but grass. 28 acres. Big parking. You can see this was the main economic artery that flowed into downtown from the Hill District into downtown. You can see what happened here. It just cut it off. Over here is a big project that we're looking to invest in and put some funding support, a huge facility that was responsible for all the training that went into, for all the plumbers, carpenters, what have you, looking to create this, put some money behind this 290,000 square feet classroom. And I'll just show you a picture of what's inside. I'm going to skip past this because I see my time ticking. Earlier, a lot of folks were talking about these integrations. In this one building, the idea is to have Pittsburgh Public Schools, the local operating engineers, Penn State, and some local green incubators and entrepreneurs. And this is directly connected to some educational programs that allows children to learn the business of green building development. I'm going to skip past this. Endpoint is that we're making sure that we're supporting grassroots community organizations from the Hill District. It's not just urban areas that need to be brought to the decision-making table. We found in rural areas as well, some of the wind turbines in Allegheny Ridge, Wind Valley out in, Somerset County, where the towering windmills for electricity generation. They're now suing the companies because of the noise decibels are too loud in those rural communities. So it's important, both rural and urban, to make sure that these folks are brought to the table just as you would for product development ideas in any company. So I want to turn it back over to Chris just to bring some closure to our points here today. Thank you.
I thought we should end with a recommendation to the government. And the first thing really is to those folks who are looking at the Economic Development Administration. If you look at the new budget initiatives, there are two new initiatives that were talked about earlier by Jonathan Salat. One is the Regional Innovation Clusters Program, $50 million with associated business incubators, and a second national network of public-private business incubators focused on economically distressed communities. But these are two different budget items, and at the moment it looks like they're being implemented by two different pieces of EDA. And it seems to us that unless you put those two together very forcibly and very directly, and at the beginning, neither one is going to be anywhere near as important as it ought to be. The second point I want to make is for anyone who was around during the Clinton administration working in the technology pieces of government. I was at NSF at the time. My husband was at DARPA, and we got involved in a thing called the TRP, the Technology Reinvestment Project. maybe some of you know what this is, and if you don't, it will take me some time to explain, but I'll be happy to talk about that afterwards because I think our time is up. But it was where six agencies got together and had one pot of money. They all worked together, argued, and made joint funding decisions. And that was a way, it was a temporary project, not a program. You could spend money quickly, get all these agencies to work together on a common problem. And we think this is a moment where, in that case, it was about dual use and commercial and military contractors working together. Right now, it could be about all the agencies that should care about these issues, about how do we take technology innovation and the innovation clusters and make them and put them in a way that really directly speaks to the community issues, and having both of the all of the agencies that work with all of those constituencies working together. So that's our recommendation.
I too want to thank you for your stamina in staying through this this last section. I should mention that this last section is about foundations. Foundations, as you know, we give money away. You don't have to go to the federal government. You don't have to go to multiple agencies. You just have to come to us. And in recognition of your stamina and persistence, the Heinz Foundation and the Moore Foundation are glad to write grants for each one of you who stays all the way to the end. So now that I've got your renewed interest, let me point out some of the things. As Ed had mentioned in his presentation, we don't do clusters in California. California doesn't do a lot of things, but somehow California nonetheless remains successful. Silicon Valley never started as a cluster, but look at what it has brought forward. One of the things it's brought forward is the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. Gordon Moore co-founded Fairchild and co-founded Intel. The creator of Moore's Law created the Moore Foundation. I'm going to talk about what the Moore Foundation has done relative to the subject matter, which is innovation toward prosperity in America. The key messages I want to leave with you, and I want to start with those, is that foundations play unique roles. We've heard foundations brought up throughout today. Today's afternoon session is more focused on that. But if you think back to all the presentations, they did mention the key role that foundations play. Let me go over them. I think that foundations can identify possible pockets of innovation and inflection points, because we are not encumbered by a great deal of the bureaucracy that exists, and in many regards because the founders generally are very focused, and many of them are, in fact, businessmen and entrepreneurs. They know how to find and they know how to deal with pockets of innovation and inflection points. Foundations can support key organizations with seed money. And the difference between seed money from a VC is that seed money from a foundation oftentimes takes a different perspective. We'll take a longer look at things. We'll do a deeper due diligence. We'll put in more capacity building for those NGOs or for those organizations that work with NGOs. And we're faster. We'll take risk. And we can catalyze consensus, because no one's going to turn a phone call down from Bill Gates or Gordon Moore or from the Packard family or many others. I was at a dinner with Pierre and Pam Amidyar. Pam and Pierre were the founders of eBay. There is a whole array of Silicon Valley and IT entrepreneurs who have been enormously successful, and they're putting their money into foundations. And the difference is that the living founders play a very key role in these foundations. They want to know that something's happened. They want to know that innovation is occurring, and they want to know that they're playing a unique role in the prosperity of America, which brought them the success that they are now turning back into the community. And as I mentioned before, foundations stay in it for the long run. The Moore Foundation particularly, Gordon Moore believes that 10,000 years is the measurement of success. 10,000 years, because he believes that anything on a short time frame, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, he doesn't believe that gets things done. If you're going to stay in to see a real demonstrable change, then commit. And the Moore Foundation generally commits for a tranche of several hundred millions of dollars for 10 to 15 years. Once the due diligence has been done, the due diligence takes about 18 to 24 months. So let me go through the agenda quickly. The Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, this is Gordon and that's Betty. They established the foundation. They wanted to create an opportunity to create on a scale that we can hope make a significant positive impact on the world for generations to come. The quick facts are, it's the 10th largest foundation in the U.S. founded only in the year 2000. It's already given away almost $2 billion. Program areas include environmental conservation, which is predominantly global, science, which is predominantly national and mainly right now Caltech, and the 30-meter telescope will be the largest optical telescope in the world on Mauna Kea in Hawaii. Gordon and Betty live full-time in Hawaii. There are two places you could put a telescope. You can put it in Chile or you can put it in Mauna Kea, Hawaii. I would think that the founder would suggest that Mauna Kea is a great place to put a telescope. And then the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'll be talking more about that a little bit later. Within the program areas, we're organized around large-scale initiatives with robust theories of change. Robust theories of change, that's the same thing as a business case. We're not going to fund anything that doesn't have a strong business case. You tell us why it's going to work. You tell us how much it's going to cost. You tell us what the measurable outcomes will be with the process goals, and then we will put it under strong consideration. Measurable outcomes is a very key, in fact, that is probably the defining element of the Moore Foundation, is that it has to have measurable outcomes, and there must be enduring impact. So we will fund, we try to leverage as much as we can, we like to come in from anywhere from 25% to 35%. If we don't find others who will come in with us, we think that the time hasn't come for that project to move forward. So again, we are always looking for collaboration, and we will put forward ideas, and if it finds fertile ground with NGOs and other organizations, then we will bring in other funders and other foundations. The three program areas are shown here. This is not for you to read, but just to say that we are very active and we are engaged with all of the major universities and academic centers, certainly in California, and many of them also nationally. This is our grant making. As you can see, a good part of it is in California. In other words, the grants are made in California to principal investigators in California, and the work is done in California. And then we also have work that's done outside of California. The grant making to California organizations are shown here. As you can see, we do quite a bit of work in the San Francisco Bay Area. The San Francisco Bay Area is rather broad. It's not just the 10 county area, actually, because my area is San Francisco Bay Area. I immediately, as a physician, would expand the area. So we go all the way from Santa Cruz up to Sacramento, and we're looking at Utah right now. So nonetheless, this is a lot of work in science and the Bay Area, as I mentioned, environmental, a lot of that's done internationally. But I will also say that the Moore Foundation has been very deeply involved in, for example, area-based sustainable fisheries, particularly in the Northeast. The grant-making of portfolios in California are predominantly to the UC system, to Caltech. Gordon was graduated from Caltech. But as you know, Caltech's one of the premier institutions in the world. And then some amount of money to the California State Universities. If you take a look at the funding impact outside of California, because the PI may be in California, the activity and the economic benefit could be outside of California. I mentioned that just in the sense that there's also some overflow. And you can see some fair amount of money also is spent here in the DC area. Environmental conservation program I mentioned to you briefly is predominantly global, so I'm going to move on and talk about science. The science area is shown here. These are the program impacts in terms of where the grants have been made. I want to highlight to you marine microbiology. This is an innovative area of bringing in disciplines and scientists to create basically a new field of scientific endeavor. That is not something that one would consider a foundation does, but then again, Gordon's not just a usual type of person. He believes that new science should be created and that new science should be able to move as quickly as possible from basic research, translational, and into application where application is appropriate. And again, a lot of the money is put into private universities, but still quite a bit in public universities, and most of that is UC. So for the Moore Foundation, we fund quick new ways to publish scientific knowledge, the belief thing being that dissemination of information and knowledge is key. You may have heard of PLOS, which is the Public Library of Science. That was in large part precipitated and catalyzed by the Moore Foundation. We developed critically important instrumentation. A fair number of the instrumentation that is now circling the world in order to ascertain changes is in collaboration with a number of universities and most recently with Google and Google Earth. As you can imagine, part of the cap and trade in terms of carbon footprint reduction is to know what forests are being preserved, what ice caps are melting, and what are the effects of drought and other areas that are the results of climate change. You don't know that unless you have some instrumentation, and the Moore Foundation has a particular interest in funding the creation of instrumentation. That then, of course, has a tremendous collateral effect in terms of additional funding. We also catalyze new interdisciplinary scientific fields. I mentioned to you about marine micro. And then we will support scientific discovery before its application. We've heard many times about serendipity. You don't know always what scientific knowledge can be immediately applicable. So you seek the best scientists to do the best type of science, and inevitably it translates into application. Let me end my presentation to talk about the San Francisco Bay Area program, particularly relative to the nursing initiative and the School of Nursing. This is in the context of workforce development. You may not know, or you may know and be surprised, that U.S. healthcare represents 16% of the GDP, a $2.1 trillion part of the economy. It added 367,000 jobs, comprising 45% of all private sector jobs added in the year 2007. That's surprising, I think, to many of you. The engine right now, if you exclude government jobs, is healthcare. Now, I won't go into an argument whether it's good or bad, appropriate, not appropriate, sustainable or not. I'm just saying that if you look around, where are the new jobs? What's the defensive industry? It's healthcare. If you take a look at hospitals, that represents the largest portion of the healthcare expenses and directly or indirectly support one of every 10 U.S. jobs. Every dollar spent by a hospital supports more than $2 of additional business activity. And with the ripple effects included, hospitals supported almost 14 million jobs and almost $2 trillion of economic activity back in 2006. That rate has only been increasing. Hospitals are also usually the largest employers in the communities and support up to 11% of a state's employment. In California, that's 7%. So in the year of February to February, over 27,000 new jobs were brought to California from healthcare. Why do I mention that? What's the driver of healthcare? The hospitals. What's the driver of hospitals? Nurses. And as you may know, there is an enormous nursing shortage. If you don't have those nurses, those hospitals will not admit patients. Those patients not admitted means that those hospitals cut down. If you look only in terms of the economic impact, that's a huge economic impact. If hospitals are not able to continue to be, as so often they are, the drivers of economy in most of the communities, particularly the rural communities of the U.S. So as I mentioned before, nurses, they are the largest component of the workforce. Their salary is considerable. You think about that. That is a lot of money, which is then magnified. If you also take a look at skilled nurses for patient care, they generate over $60,000 annually in reduced medical costs and improved national productivity, and that's only the partial estimate of economic value. So what we've looked at is, for various reasons, how do we get involved in healthcare? We've decided to get involved in healthcare relative to nurses. Part of it is Betty's commitment to better quality, because she was a victim of quality that could be better. But it's also an understanding that a lot of these women, and most are women, support their families now. This is the first time a recession has resulted in, as you know, more white men being unemployed than other sectors of the workforce. So those nurses play a very, very vital role. They also represent, when they execute their jobs professionally, represent huge cost savings for the U.S., California being one where the readmission rate is frighteningly high. And as such, then, anything that we can do to improve the nursing and the healthcare community is to the benefit of the economy and, of course, to the patients and families. This is, I guess you'd call a cluster. We work with over 71 institutions, And by working, I mean we bring them all together in the rigorous, disciplined approach that the Moore Foundation has of achieving outcomes. We invest in the universities, and we directly support the development of nurses as well as nurse educators. In fact, we put $100 million into creating a brand new nursing school at UC Davis. That's an understanding that it's the limited number of faculty that is resulting in hundreds of thousands of qualified applicants being turned away from nursing school. So the Moore Foundation, we created a nursing school. Foundations can do that sort of thing. I should also mention that high quality healthcare saves money, and these are some of the examples in Moore Foundation funded programs that have improved quality, but more importantly have decreased healthcare costs. Those decreased healthcare costs result in lower premiums. Those lower premiums result in less payment by employers. And as you know, employer-sponsored healthcare has been one of the big issues in the prosperity or the continuing prosperity of America. The Science Technology Museums, this is our cluster. We work with these institutions, particularly the ones that are highlighted in red. We do that because we're investing in our future. This is an example of being in it for the long run. We support informal science education. We've increased the professional development for teachers. We've enhanced classroom teaching of students. And we've anticipated the results being more competent and confident teachers. That's our future, are those students who are more engaged and knowledgeable and more literate and thoughtful citizens is the outcome. We're in it for the long run. It'll take a generation, but the Moore Foundation, created as one in perpetuity, will be around to see the fruits of our labor. Thank you very much.
Does anyone have any questions or want to throw it open for questions at this point?
Dan Berglund with SSTI. Two questions. One is, I think if you look nationally, there's a role of locally oriented foundations like Heinz in Pittsburgh, the Stowers in Kansas City, Danforth in St. Louis, Flynn Foundation in Arizona, that serve as a real catalyst for innovation and technology-based economic development. I'm curious, Chris, specifically to you, whether you all talk with each other, if there's a vehicle by which that occurs. So that's the first question. And then the second question for the whole panel is, you know, a large part of what I think we've been talking about today is the federal government's economic development structure is rooted in the 1960s. And to a large extent, I think the national foundations are still sort of in the 1960s when it comes to economic development as well. You've got the Kauffman Foundation that's interested in entrepreneurship, but not really seeing a successor to Ford and Kellogg for this new economy. And so I'm curious as to observations on potential successor foundations on a national level.
Okay, I'll take your first. If I just hold this down. All right. So the first question, we absolutely do talk to each other. We should also point out the yeah, that's a bit. Thanks. Endowments and other Pittsburgh foundations have always worked closely together, and we worked closely with the state, for example, in creating the Ben Franklin Program and all of the other technology-based economic development organizations. We jointly fund a lot of those things. So on the one hand, we work closely with the ones in our region, but that wasn't the question you asked. You asked about what about foundations nationally. There are lots of mechanisms for us to collaborate and communicate. There's a Council on Foundations, which is a national organization. Max King, who was the president of the Heinz Endowments until a year ago, was the president of the Council on Foundations, and I think the Pittsburgh foundations are always in the leadership there, and we meet fairly often. Bomani and I were just there in December for a meeting with the Council on Foundations, and at that meeting I was joined jointly hosted by Brookings, there was a lot of talk about metropolicy and clusters, and Valerie Jarrett actually spent an hour and a half with the group. It was a fairly small group about this size, just talking back and forth about how can the Obama administration work more closely with the foundations and how can we all, you know, work toward the same goals. She actually has a long history, and so does the president, in understanding how foundations can really do a good job in their communities and really leveraging federal policy, which is what we try to do. One of Teresa Hines Carey's favorite expressions is connect the dots, and that's really what we try to do. We'll never be as much money as the federal government, but we can be more flexible, and a little bit of really flexible money can often make a great big system work a lot better. So that's really, I guess, and actually the second question, do you mind if, as long as I'm standing here, I'll answer the second question. There's a huge sea change going on in the philanthropic community. As was pointed out before, Pierre Omidyar and some of the other, Google and Gates and the new entrepreneurs, as we've seen in the nation, people's incomes polarizing. In other words, as you go to the 10%, 1%, 1.1%, you're seeing a lot of income really, a lot of income in a small percentage of the population, and those newly rich folks are essentially all becoming philanthropists, and they're trying to become philanthropists in a new way. And what you're seeing is a lot of innovation in the philanthropic community, a lot of social entrepreneurship. People are telling me that when you apply for a 501c3 now, it takes forever because they've been inundated with applications over the last year. Everybody wants to start a new social enterprise because there's so much foundation money out there to do it with. So there's a lot of innovation going on in foundations, and we're trying to be there. Mrs. Hines prides herself on being one of the first venture philanthropists, and now we call that by another name, but it's really the same thing, is how can you push the envelope right up to the limit of what you're legally allowed to do in order to do the right things.
I would agree that the complete sea change. We just completed a retreat with a board foundation at a presentation by Bridgespan, who set it up by Tom Tierney, who was formerly of Bain. And he highlighted three main factors. As Chris had mentioned, there's a huge amount of money that's been made by entrepreneurs. And they are going to spend that money. Many times they're going to spend that money while still alive. That's giving while living. As you know, the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates, decided that their foundation will self-terminate 50 years after their death. Jeff Skoll is very engaged. Pierre Omidyar, whom I mentioned. Many of these are moving to areas of social responsibility, but measurable social responsibility. Secondly, there's more transparency. And the third element is that these problems are so huge that it does require working with private industry, as well as working with the government, as well as affecting policy. That, I think, what Chris described is to the edge of that which had traditionally been defined foundations. We are 501c3, so we cannot influence either pending or actual legislation, but we can certainly educate, and that's one thing that foundations can do very well, is we can educate, we can convene consensus, and we can catalyze movement.
Chuck.
Well, that's what we're trying to do, too. We just want people to get it right. But I'd like to ask a more technical question. Have you tried or thought about expanding your portfolio, for example, in the hospitals, and perhaps you already do this, to spread your commitment to attract more matching funds or to work with federal state governments that, you know, will put in X if you can put in Y? Is that an active approach? Or?
We always like matching. We don't call it matching. In-kind contributions, whether in cash or by other resources. But we have not gone to the government for various reasons. So we work primarily with private industry, other foundations, and with the grantees themselves.
Do you build a consortium of foundations for some of these efforts?
There is a consortium of grant makers, as well as the major, which include RWJF, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Hartman Foundation, and others. So the foundations certainly work well and often with themselves. It may be that with a new administration, there'll be a different approach that's very fruitful government.
But a catch on Chris is connecting the dots. Is there something that any of you up there think that that we need to do in a pressing fashion?
Pilot demonstration projects, especially with Recovery Act funds. I mean, a lot of these, there's so much money coming in so quickly. For example, the workforce, Pennsylvania, I'm going to stand up there. Pennsylvania Workforce Investment Board came to us and said, we're getting $92 million in Pennsylvania right away, like next week. And everybody's already strapped, we're understaffed, and if we get that money and we're graded on how fast we spend it, we're going to shovel it out to the usual suspects. And that means that the people who are not already in the system and understand how to navigate it are just going to lose. So what we actually did, and this is going to sound weird, why would you need foundation money? But those federal dollars, you were not permitted to spend them on staff. And so you could hire a consulting firm and staff it that way, which is what you normally do. But again, to do something really quick, we funded a position, just a person who had a Rolodex of community organizations on the ground, had experience with workforce investment, and just funded a position in the Workforce Investment Board to just help them spend the money properly and help them find new people who could come in and get some of those grants so that it wouldn't just be the boats that are already high get lifted more and the ones that aren't already lifted go back down. We just can't afford to use – this is a one-time, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And just the same way that my father was able to be put into the middle class through the GI Bill – but if you were African American, you were left out. We just can't afford to have that happen. This is a one-time opportunity, and we have to make sure that we do all we can to make sure that it lifts all boats and doesn't further polarize us.
I'll take moderator Progrin and ask one question. And when does this panel end? In 5 minutes? Or? Okay. Okay. I'd rather hear them than me, so I'll ask the question. I think the interesting thing is we've gone from picking winners and losers to the people who have every right in this world to pick winners, and that's one of the unique things about the foundations, that it's their money, they can do it with what they want. And this is, I guess, to a certain extent, extended to George. Your foundation and several of the others in Silicon Valley are basically the end results of some of the most efficient companies in the world, people who really knew how to use Moore's Law and other things to squeeze out costs and really get the economy at a new level. I'm thinking that if you look at manufacturing, basically went total quality management, then we had Lean Six Sigma, it went to the service sector. Probably the last refuge of non-quality is, to a certain extent, the people who traditionally receive money from foundations, some educational institutions and others. And I wondered, in addition to measurable outcomes and enduring impact, have you thought of one enduring impact being possibly extending quality and lean to your recipients?
Yeah, let me preface my comment by saying that Gordon, Betty Moore Foundation, but Gordon is quite profound in his insight. Gordon trained as a scientist, as a chemist. He was in the hardware industry, semiconductors. Didn't deal with software and certainly didn't deal with wet software, which is the carbon-based element. He's kind of silicone-based. However, we did have some very good discussions about capacity building. And let me just highlight Chris. We found that too. We got calls from many, many of our grantees who said, I want to apply. I don't have enough people. I don't have enough resources. I don't know how to apply to the federal government, and I need someone to help me get this thing done. So I think that's a very key element of capacity building. The second element of capacity building is finding the right people before you can instill the components of efficiency. Let me just highlight two things. First is we find more often than not that people that go into NGOs are did it by choice. So they're not in the for-profit industry. So they bring with them a certain vitality, a certain passion, and perhaps a certain element that does not lend itself as well to Six Sigma. So let me just highlight that cultural issue. The second thing I would highlight is that a lot of the activities in which we are engaged don't lend themselves to Six Sigma either. Certainly, perhaps, to components of lean in the manufacturing industry, and I think more likely to continuous quality improvement. The engagement in broad social enterprise, distressingly, may be at times more, as Mani said, more like jazz. In other words, stay engaged, stay together, rather than get that melody out as efficiently as possible and do it in half the time that you would in the first cycle time. So just some comments there.
Well, thanks, everyone.